Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Edward Dowd representing Dr. Brian Ellison and making argument for Brian and Mark Ellison. The conspiracy and the false tax return convictions in this case should be set aside and the indictment dismissed due to the fact that this trial was fundamentally flawed in a number of ways. The defense was never allowed to present its theory in the proper way.
Mr. Dowd, you can raise that podium if you want.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, Your Honor. The assistant U.S. attorney in this case had the IRS FOIA unit withhold documents from the defense and assured the court over and over again that he and the agents were not involved in the FOIA requests and that FOIA and the prosecution team were separate entities when he knew that he and the agents were working with the FOIA unit for months. There's one entry that says he, referring to the DOJ attorney, he does not want any information released that would harm his prosecution. Even after trial, more evidence was presented to the court in camera. Even after that, more exculpatory documents were provided by the FOIA unit to the defense. The Brady violations, the restrictions on the defense's right to cross-examine the government's key witness, the revenue agent, the refusal to allow an accountant and certified fraud examiner to testify for the defense, and the admission of dividend theory evidence combined to deprive the Ellisons of a fair trial. The Brady violations. It is clear from the FOIA records, which are attached to our brief as part of our appendix, that the FOIA unit was talking to Special Agent Tim Arsenault, Revenue Agent Sharon Vandenberg, and AUSA Stephen Mohenrick for months. Entries such as, Tim will call back with Sharon and Steve discuss the case. DOJ attorney wants to see what is being released. Docs being sent to Sharon or Tim. Waiting for an okay from Criminal Investigation Department of Justice to release. It is so clear from the records that many documents are being withheld and that some are corrupted or destroyed. And it's also clear there's very regular contact between the FOIA unit and the prosecution team. At the same time, the prosecutors are telling the defense over and over again, we've got an open file policy. You're getting everything here. You're getting everything. And the trial court, the judge before Judge Kays, denied all the defense motions for Brady material and Rule 16 discovery because he was being told, you're getting everything. They were not. During trial, a defense lawyer told Judge Kay that they had made a FOIA request and that the government had withheld numerous documents. And that's when the assistant began his deception, and he told the court, objection to the classification of the government. The FOIA request was not answered by the U.S. Attorney's Office. It was answered by the IRS, a completely separate entity. Even later in the case, the assistant said, the IRS is totally separate from anybody involved in this prosecution. They have their own policy about what is disclosed and what isn't. Even later, once again, and this happened more times than I'm giving you, the court was struggling with this issue, this late disclosure of 400 pages of exculpatory evidence as the defense was presenting it to him, and the court said, Mr. Mohenrick has been unequivocal that he has no control of any documents that they're withholding. Is that true? Is it right, though? Assistant U.S. Attorney, yes, that is. He was misleading the court about that, and he succeeded, and he made the court believe that the government was not involved, that the prosecution team was not involved in withholding any documents or the late disclosure of the documents. I don't think anyone can trust anything that that assistant is saying. It's obvious that it was intentional misconduct, intentionally misleading the court. So that makes me, and it may be the biggest prejudice in this case and the biggest concern about whether this verdict should be reversed, is we don't know what's out there. We don't know what has not been produced. And Victoria Osborne, the defense expert witness that was not allowed to testify, she finds in her in document 258 that many, many documents have not been produced even now. At one point, when the defense counsel was saying to the court, this is all exculpatory, Your Honor, the IRS has civilly assessed the amended returns. We didn't know that. That's an admission. Revenue Agent West treated all the income as earned income to Dr. Ellison and not to the corporation, so they should not be able to now claim that it was dividends as opposed to earned income and double tax the corporation and the doctor.
But wouldn't that only go to the issue of restitution?
Wouldn't that only address the issue of restitution? How does that affect the conviction for fraud?
Yes, that's a good point. It affects the conviction for fraud because all of this evidence goes directly to whether this act, these acts by Dr. Ellison and his brother, were willful. And that's really what these numbers are going to. It was a huge part of our case that we were not allowed to present. I was not a trial counsel, Your Honor.
I understand.
It was a huge part of the defense case that he filed amended returns in 2005, or in 2006. He hired an accountant in 2005, filed them in 2006, and had paid $488,000 plus interest on top of that. And that was a big part that before he was ever charged, he had filed amended, accurate returns and had paid the government more. I mean, that's another point of error here, obviously, is that the court would not even allow the defense to cross-examine the revenue agent who said, oh, there's $1.1 million of tax loss here. He would not even let them cross-examine that agent saying, well, didn't he pay over $500,000 with his amended returns? Amended returns under U.S. versus Dyer only raise an inference of mistake. They do not raise an inference of fraud because the policy is the government wants people to file amended returns, say what really happened, and pay the correct taxes.
Well, can we talk a little bit more about this limitation on cross-examination? How did this evolve? I mean, so the government puts on evidence about the indirect dividend theory.
That's correct.
Right. And now, had it come up before the case agent testified? Or was she the primary witness on this issue?
She was the primary witness on that issue.
Okay.
And she did testify. What
was it that you wanted to cross-examine her about, and what was it that the government objected to and the court sustained?
The agent said, and it was strangely presented, because the assistant said, can you tell the jury what the tax loss is? And she said, well, I don't have my papers. I can't really add it up right now. And he asked a leading question. Was it in the neighborhood of $1.1 million? The agent said, that sounds practical. Yes. That seems like a very vague way to be presenting such an important fact. It does go directly to willfulness. Then when the defense started to cross-examine the revenue agent, and that was devastating evidence in front of that jury, obviously, that he's still owed, the government lost $1.1 million, and it made them think that the amended returns were false and that he was still trying to cheat the IRS. So it was a huge piece of evidence in this case. The AUSA then objected and said, this cross-examination about the amended returns is outside of the scope of direct, which is clearly wrong. Certainly you have a right to say, you just said there was $1.1 million loss. It certainly directly applies to that to say, well, didn't he pay over $500,000 before he was ever charged? Did you deduct that from the $1.1 million? The court agreed. He said, yes, this is outside of the scope of direct, but unfortunately that was error. And then he said, you can do this down the road, which once again is error. And he did put in the evidence of accountant Hauser. He let the defense prove that they had filed amended returns and what had been paid. That's not the same as getting to confront a key government witness at the time of the devastating evidence and cross-examining her and hurting her and make her admit that, well, yeah, I didn't include $500,000 in that.
Did she give any explanation as to how she came to the $1.1 million figure? Did she talk about the indirect dividend theory and how those numbers work together?
Yes, she did.
And were you not allowed to cross-examine her about that issue?
They were not allowed to cross-examine about the fact that the doctor had paid a total of $900,000 in taxes for these years because they couldn't put in the $500,000. He originally paid $400,000, then later paid $500,000. They were allowed to cross-examine on the other issues. It's the amended return, which goes to his lack of willfulness, that I think was the biggest error in this case. I think it's totally exculpatory. It under U.S. versus Dyer, it goes right to the key issue in this case. And yet the government succeeded in keeping the defense from cross-examining on that issue and succeeded in keeping Victoria Osborne off the stand. And once again, the assistant stopped them from testifying on an improper basis. He said to the court, the assessment on the returns in the IRS documents that Victoria Osborne is relying on to prove that the IRS has finally assessed and accepted the amended returns was a clerical error. There's no evidence, and I don't think they're going to tell you today that was a clerical error. He just made that up because it sounded good at the time. And then he said, also, Mrs. Osborne can't understand the codes. She is extreme. She spent over 20,000 hours on IRS matters, has testified in numerous criminal cases, federal and state. She is extremely well qualified. Keeping her from testifying about these issues, combined with refusing to allow the defense to cross-examine the revenue agent about the amended returns, was extremely extremely prejudicial to the defense, kept us from showing that the amended returns were accurate, that there were no willful violations. I mean, jumping back to the revenue agent, the court prohibited the defense from cross-examining her, and she was an expert witness, clearly, with the fact that the defendant had filed amended tax returns before being indicted, that the returns were accurate, that he had declared all income earned by the corporation through his services as income to himself, that he paid $488,000 in additional tax, and had paid a total of $900,000 for the years in issue. That never came in. The Garber and Kritzer cases, which we cite in our brief, make it clear the defendant cannot be held to have acted willfully when the taxability of the income is not clear. In this case, the taxability of the income to the corporation, the double taxation to the corporation, was very unclear, and that's what the government got to prove that was very prejudicial. In Garber, the court held that it was error not to let the defense experts explain why the income was not taxable. The court said this is a disputed issue, and yet the defense experts weren't allowed to testify to it. The court held that a defendant has a right to negate willfulness with exactly this kind of evidence. In U.S. versus Malice, the court held that the convictions could not stand, as they were based on a point of law that was vague or highly debatable. And that's certainly true here. And you can tell that when you look at the cases cited by the defense and by the government. There are cases going all over the place, and it's hard to draw lines about which each mean. But the tax loss here was definitely a highly debatable proposition, and the expert should have been allowed to explain the defects in the government's position, how it contrasted with the position taken by the IRS civil side, that these are assessed, agreed to, accurate returns, and earned income.
The government's position, as I understand, is that the whole issue of the taxation to the corporation is an irrelevant issue.
Yes, that's what they're saying.
Because what we're really talking about is the taxation to the individuals, which you now concede was done improperly.
I'm saying that the...
It may not be criminal, but it was improper.
The numbers were not correct. He should have declared the rest of that income. And he did in his amended returns before he was charged.
Did they make that... Were they clear at trial that they were no longer contesting the fact that they had improperly taken these deductions?
I'm not sure that was clear, Your Honor.
Were they backtracking? Backtracking on that issue and saying that they...
When you say they, do you mean the government?
No, the defendants. Filed the amended returns.
Yes.
But were they acknowledging at trial that that the amended returns in essence reflected an improper deduction taken in the late 1990s and early 2000s?
They were maybe implicitly, but they were certainly acknowledging that the amended returns were accurate and that the doctor who had earned, and this is an interesting and important point here on the dividend theory and whether the corporation should have been charged, that he earned every penny of that money. It was a personal services corporation where he earned all of the money, and it's very clear under Eighth Circuit law, the Vanuk case that we cite and the Kral case, that when a trust is collapsed, the income is charged to the earner. And it was very clear in the amended returns, and getting back to your question, it was very clear in the amended returns that he was declaring all of that money as income to him and paid taxes on it and the correct amount of taxes, which they, once again, couldn't ask the agent about. In Curtis versus Commissioner of the IRS, the court held, in the case of a professional personal services corporation, the best evidence of the value of the services provided is the profit made. The government cases are not collapsed trust cases like this, where Vanuk and Kral make it very clear that that income is taxed to the earner. There are other income-producing assets involved in the money that is supposedly diverted. It's not all earned income. Like in Zamzam, the tax court case, they said there's a lot of other money involved here, money coming in from rentals and that sort of thing. There are also, most of their cases are guidelines cases, which under the guidelines they're required to combine all taxes that they can claim. They're not personal service corporations, and there are no amended returns. I see my time is up for now.
Thank
you.
Very well. We'll hear from the government. Good morning, sir. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Phil Coppi. I'm with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Kansas City, and I'm a member of our appellate unit. I was not involved in this case at the trial level. My involvement began with the filing of the brief. And the reason for that, quite simply, is because of the allegations that have been made actually before the case was even indicted regarding Mr. Mohenrick's ethics, government misconduct, suppression of evidence, document dumps. You know, the record is replete with these allegations, and he has been pretty much referred to as everything but the spawn of Satan. And I suspect that if I look in some of these returns or some of these records, that might be there too. So it was believed that someone who was not personally involved in the case, someone who has not been subject to these allegations, ought to take a second look at it. I expected to find something. I expected to find some record or something that perhaps we didn't disclose. As you can see from the appendix in this case, which is 12 volumes, this case went on for 4 years. We're talking literally of thousands of records. But you know, much to my amazement, this is a situation where we went out of our way to give the defense everything they asked for and more. When they made a request for particular documents, we didn't just bring a box over and say, here you go. We electronically filed it. We prepared an exhibit. They had the hard copies. We consistently did that. But there's a reason that the defense has made these allegations, in my view, and it's simply because they don't have a defense. They never had a defense. This is a situation, by the time of trial, they had agreed that all of these deductions, these management fee deductions, were improper. This should have been income to Brian Ellison. And the only issue at trial was the question of intent. Now, in a normal situation like this, where you're dealing with a trust of this nature, you might be able to come up with a plausible argument because Jim Quay was an attorney, the accountant, Lynn Bell Osina, was an accountant. Our defendants were a doctor and his brother, who was the office manager, as far as the record shows, no legal training of any type. So you might have, in this case, a plausible argument, except for a couple of things. Number one, the way that these trusts were set up was so transparent, where you set up a series of domestic and offshore trusts and you funnel the money, income masquerading as management fees, from one trust to the other until ultimately it comes back to Brian Ellison as through credit cards and in some cases checks. I mean, anyone who is familiar, who's ever paying taxes, knows that it can't possibly be that easy to disguise your income in that fashion. All right. But the biggest problem they had was that the Ellisons had been represented by Michael Stelmacki, this accountant, for years, very knowledgeable individual. And throughout the process, he was sending them letters warning them that this was illegal. And he wasn't just saying, get out, it's illegal. He was sending them information from the IRS. He was explaining to him that, you can paint an apple orange and call it an orange, but it's still an apple. I mean, he very explicitly explained to them. They didn't listen. Even Lynn Bellosina, who was the accountant for the Aegis system and who originally told them that this was okay, wrote them a letter and said, change of plans. The IRS is on us. I checked with an attorney. This is illegal. Go file amended returns. What did the Ellisons do in that case? Did they file amended returns? No. No. They contributed more money, over $1.1 million into this. So it's clear from the record that they didn't care. So consequently, like, what sort of a defense do you have here? Well, the one thing they did have was the fact that when Mr. Stelmacki, their accountant, told them that the IRS was closing in, they went to Mr. Hauser and they filed amended personal returns. Now, not amended corporate returns. You know, you heard Mr. Dowd talk about collapsing the trust. They never collapsed the trust. Their trust is still out there. As far as the record shows, those returns are on file. They're still incorrect. So, now, granted, the amended returns can be looked at in a couple of different ways. I mean, if you're the prosecution, you say it shows they knew all along that what they were doing was fraudulent. If you're the defendant, the argument is the contrary. All right. So the jury had that in front of them. The jury knew that they had filed these amended returns, but faced with all of the other information from, you know, from the principals here, the jury really had no difficulty in realizing or in understanding that the reason they filed those amended returns was because they knew they were going to get caught. All right. The records that we're talking about, the records that they claim they didn't get or didn't get timely, had to do with the IRS's treatment of these amended returns back in 2006, years after the fraud was alleged to have been completed. Their argument is, and I refer to it as the, and I haven't heard of this before, the processing clerk defense. Their argument is, apparently, that if you submit amended returns, and those returns are processed. In this case, by that processing, I mean that information is inputted. It goes on to your IRS transcript. And I think they had to fill out a form or two, and I'm not a tax expert by any means. I don't quite know what the numbers were. But they had to fill out some form to allow them to cash the check. The check was for over $500,000. They obviously wanted to cash that. But the argument that the defendants have made throughout is that somehow that amounted to a final determination of their tax liability. Now, remember, they didn't even file amended corporate returns. And this argument about should the management fees be considered constructive dividends, or should the IRS have an obligation to reclassify that as earned income? And that's the issue here. We think, and Judge bought it and believed it. We believe that the case law is clear. Judge Kays, cited in his order denying their motion for new trial, cites an Eighth Circuit case where controlling stockholders divert corporate income to themselves. Such diverted funds shall be treated as constructive dividends. The fact
well,
that
well, yes. Let me interrupt you there for just a minute. It's you're sort of getting to what I think is maybe one of the things I think is a bit troubling about the case, and that is this limitation on cross-examination. You put this evidence on. You say it's $1.1 million. You say that you put on that you introduced the constructive dividend theory through your witness, which you now say is irrelevant.
Well,
and therefore the judge was right to limit cross-examination. Do you have cases that say that when the government puts on irrelevant information that it's then okay to limit the cross-examination?
Well, it's irrelevant to the theory of the defense that they're raising.
But you put it on. What gives you the right to say?
Okay.
You can't cross-examine on a theory that we presented.
No. Sharon Vandenberg was a summary witness. She was testifying as to all the evidence that had previously been put in there. It was all in there. The restriction on cross-examination had to do with how the processing center in Kansas City had treated the civil returns. It had nothing.
No, you wouldn't let her get in. As I understand, they couldn't get into a very detailed examination of the dividend theory.
No,
and,
no.
And you wouldn't let them get into the amount of the loss, which was the $1.1 million figure.
No, that's not, Judge. That's a mistake. It's not true. The cross-examination in this case, if you look at the record, was limited to The exclusion was limited to her being questioned as to how the IRS treated the amended returns. Her testimony concerning how she came to this figure, she said that she considered the returns, she considered witness testimony. What she didn't consider was these amended to returns filed years later. That was all she was prevented from testifying about. And the jury, remember, was not asked to find a particular amount of loss. In fact, they were told it wasn't relevant. As long as the returns were false, as long as they conspired to file false returns, that's it. Judge Miller, I wanted to follow up on a question you asked earlier when you were talking about the relevance of this. And as you pointed out, the relevance would apply restitution. I mean, that would be an issue, which they didn't raise, by the way. And the second potential issue would be range of punishment. And, you know, if the loss was $1 million as opposed to $500,000, that would affect the punishment slightly. That's not an issue here because the judge deviated so far down from the guidelines.
Let me ask this.
Yes.
Is the issue whether the original returns were fraudulent or whether the amended returns were accurate or fraudulent?
Well, the answer is the first, yes. Yes. The fact that they filed amended returns, as I said, to us, that is significant in the sense it shows they knew that, all right, their argument it shows that, no, as soon as we found out, we took steps to correct it. That's refuted by the evidence that shows that from the get-go, they were warned repeatedly that, you know, they would wind up in prison if they persisted in this conduct. It wasn't until the net was closing in that they finally did it. That they finally, when they got that call from their accountant who said the IRS is here with a subpoena, that's when they realized that they needed to do something. But
what
yes.
relevance are amended returns then in a case like this? Is it are amended returns, do they ever constitute a safe harbor, as it were, against prosecution?
No. I mean, they don't. I mean, they're admissible.
Is the jury ever instructed on the effect of the fact that they had filed amended returns?
No. And there's case law. There's a Supreme Court case, which I think is in our brief, which states that the fact that you later amend your returns before the prosecution does not operate as a defense. Now, as I understand it from what little I know about the IRS, there used to be a policy that if the taxpayer voluntarily came forward and corrected his returns before there was an investigation, before they spotted, that generally the policy of the IRS was not to prosecute. Now that's actually been changed. I think it was changed in like 1952. So, yeah, I mean, it's relevant in the sense that, and again, one of the reasons that the defense focused so much on this, of course, is that, you know, given the fact that their good faith defense in terms of what they knew from their accountants was pretty much blown out of the water. That's pretty much all they had to argue. That, look, we filed these amended returns. But to argue that for some reason this limits the defendant's liability to $500,000 instead of $1 million, and then the question is, so what? I mean, isn't that something like a bank robber saying he's innocent because we say he stole $10,000 from the bank, and he says, no, it was only $9,000. I didn't get that extra $1,000. I mean, that's not a defense. That's not going to help you. And why is it on center stage here? The simple answer is because they don't have anything else, you know? And so they've got this, as I call it, the processing clerk defense, and they've got the argument that the government, you know, through the get-go was not disclosing stuff. And again, this disclosure, this FOIA stuff, has to do with the Kansas City Service Center processing documents. And apparently the IRS has a great ability to generate a lot of paper. But in terms of significance, relevance, it's absent. And it's like, what documents didn't you get that prove anything in terms of, they haven't been able to say that.
Well, can I go back a minute to the cross-examination?
Yes.
And I'm back looking at the transcript now. The defendant says, you get on the stand, you put your witness on the stand, and you ask her, what's the amount that they still owe?
Right.
You say $1.1 million, and probably done with some dramatic flair to make the jury realize it's over $1 million that they embezzled or stole from the federal government. And then when it comes time to start asking her about the $1.1 million figure, you say, well, that's beyond the scope of direct. Now, how is that beyond the scope of direct?
It's not asking about how she came up with it. They were asking about the part that the judge, and the judge made this clear, the part that the judge...
No, he asked him, does that include payment? Here's the question. Okay. That includes the payments he made with the original return and the subsequent payment. Asking about the $1.1 million. So you're asking, how do you get to the $1.1 million? Objection, Your Honor. It's beyond the scope. And what they made on the amended returns is irrelevant.
Well, be that as it may, I don't have it in front of me. Be that as it may, their expert was allowed to testify as to how much they paid, how he calculated it. All right, Mr. Mulhenrick has sent me a note that says tax loss is the tax loss in August of 2003 before the payments. Okay, so they were talking about something different. All right.
But the $1.1 million includes the dip. No, they're not talking about something different. Because that gets back to Judge Miller's question, because that's the figure you use for restitution.
Well, the record is their expert.
And if they're talking about something different, why can't they cross-examine so they can clarify what they're talking about?
Well, my answer to that, again, and this is what Judge Case pointed out, this was... To the extent that it had any relevance at all, this was fully litigated. Their expert was allowed to testify how he came to his conclusions. We testified how we came to our conclusions. I personally think, looking at the case law, this is a legal issue, that the case law is clear how this is to be treated. All right? But be that as it may, the jury was aware that the extra $500,000 that the government said they owed was based upon our constructive dividend theory. They disputed it. We didn't. So even, Judge, if you say, okay, we should have allowed him to go into that, clearly I think the judge's intent was to stay away from, you know, did she consider in her calculations their amended returns. I mean, obviously the amount was significant, but not the question of – How did you figure this out and that sort of thing. So regardless of whether, like I said, I want to repeat myself, regardless of whether you have a situation where you say, well, you know, she'd allowed that question, the jury understood. There was never any question here how the two different figures came about. They knew that we had the extra $500,000 because of the way that they filed these returns. Their argument here is that we needed to go back and basically redo their return for them and treat those management fees as earned income. We say the case law is clear that you don't have to do that. But needless to say, the jury wasn't asked and wasn't required to come up with any amount of loss. The jury knew that, bottom line, it was at least $550,000 if you just looked at, you know, Brian Ellefson's income. And they understood how you got to this other figure. So
I don't want to beat a dead horse. Well, if it's irrelevant as to the amount of loss, then why was there pages and pages of testimony about the dividend theory that would have added additional money to the loss? Why not just say this was the loss in 2003, end of discussion?
All right. Well, Mr. Henrick is telling me that the judge did permit them to ask about the dividends. They did ask about the dividends. Payments on amended returns are irrelevant as far as the tax loss in 2003 is concerned. That's our point. But again,
well,
Judge, I know you say beat it to death, but it's like you can't take it's not like, you know, we prevented them from getting into their theory of defense by basically saying, I didn't consider the amended payments in my calculations, or I didn't consider, I'm sorry, the amended returns in my calculations. When the evidence of the amended returns is there, they've got an expert that explains. The jury understood what the difference was. The jury understood why there was this discrepancy. And again, whether you're talking about $1 million or you're talking about $500,000, you know, I can see a situation where if you're talking about a fairly minor tax loss, if you're talking about $2,000-$3,000, for example, I mean, you might infer that who's going to cheat on their taxes, who's going to risk going to prison for that small amount. When you're talking about the numbers that you're talking about here, it seems to me that whether it's $1 million or a half a million, This is a huge amount of money. And again, you know, you're talking about isolated cross-examination. And again, as I understand what Judge Kayes was saying, is that she didn't talk about anything regarding their amended returns that's outside the scope of cross-examination. But be that as it may, this was the whole case. There was ample evidence about their theory, our theory, to the extent that it was relevant, it was before the jury. So clearly, any error, which I don't believe there was one, had to be harmless. I see I have 51 seconds left, and if there are no questions, this is usually the point that ask the court to affirm the conviction, but I want to say one other thing, and that is Judge Kayes, you know, went out of his way here to point out in a special order that he believed that there was no misconduct, that there was no Brady violation. The allegations in this case got so extreme that local counsel even took their name off one of the pleadings. And I hope that the court just doesn't write an opinion saying, well, you know, this evidence isn't relevant and it's could, you know, so therefore, even if there's a Brady violation, it has to be harmless. I think the court should come down hard and say, you know, we hold the government to a high standard. They're supposed to disclose whatever it is they have that's exculpatory. And we're gonna come down harshly if they don't. But by the same token, I think you need to come down harshly when there are false allegations made throughout the case from the beginning to the end that have absolutely no bearing and no merit. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Very well. We'll hear from Mr. Dowd in rebuttal. Good morning.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Right? The Assistant United States Attorney never made any reference or any defense to the fact that the Assistant U.S. Attorney in charge of the trial team was misleading the court on a very regular basis. And I think the court should look at that.
That's a pretty serious allegation. I hope for your client's sake that it's true.
Yes, Your Honor. It's definitely true if you look at the addendum and then compare that, like I did in the opening part, of the Assistant U.S. Attorney was clearly misleading the court about his trial team's involvement with the FOIA office and what was being disclosed and when. And the FOIA records show that he was telling them, I don't want anything disclosed that will harm my case. When you see that kind of intention, and I don't do that lightly. I was the U.S. attorney here. I was an assistant U.S. attorney. The only times that I can think of that I've ever accused an assistant U.S. attorney of misconduct, one was fired and the other was prosecuted for suborning perjury. This assistant U.S. attorney was misleading Judge Kayes.
Well, Judge Kayes didn't think so. And he wrote a very pretty strong opinion saying that.
He wrote an opinion saying Judge Kayes, I think, was trying to give the defendants a fair trial, but he relied on the assistant U.S. attorney constantly, and that's why we were not allowed to cross-examine the revenue agent properly, why Ms. Osborne was not allowed to testify. The assistant said the jury knew what it should do here. The jury knew what it should do here. The jury did not have the evidence. The defendants were deprived of the right to cross-examine the key government witness on $1.1 million loss. What is involved in that? Did he pay $500,000? That would have been the first question. Didn't he pay $500,000 with amended returns? Aren't those returns accurate? Didn't he declare all of the income? If he declared all of that income coming to him and paid taxes on it, how can you now be charging the corporation? It would have destroyed their entire $1.1 million argument for maybe one or two or six of those jurors. That was never allowed to be presented, and it was very destructive.
Would it have made a difference, the fact that on one hand you have a $1 million loss versus a $500,000 loss? Do you believe that the jury would have said, we would believe they're guilty if it's a million, but not if it's $500,000? Is that what you're arguing?
No, that's not my argument, Judge, but I get your point. If the jury believed that the amended returns were accurate and that he had paid the right taxes, they could have said there's zero tax loss here. And that's what I think is correct. The assistant U.S. attorney kept saying this is all the defense had going for them. That's why they've taken this position. All they had going for them.
How would that have negated guilt of fraud back when they filed the initial tax return? I mean, so, you know, if you commit tax fraud and
yes.
then You said you're a former, I know you're a former U.S.
Yes.
attorney. And you commit tax fraud, and then while the grand jury is deliberating, you quick file an amended return. That's not a defense.
No, but it's not a defense by itself. But it does go to intent. It goes to willfulness. And that's what we're talking about here. That's what the government keeps saying. That's all they had was their intent defense. That's right. And the heart of that was when he realized there was a problem, he filed amended returns. And if you think those amended returns are accurate, he doesn't owe the government anything because you paid $500,000 and declared all the income, earned income to him as the Personal Services Corporation can do, collapse the trust, then there is no tax owed.
There is no dividend tax owed.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Did your client testify?
No, he did not.
So we don't know what he was thinking back when he got all these letters in 1999 and 2000, 2001 saying, this is a fraud, you better get out of it.
I'll say one thing about those letters, Judge. The evidence was 100% clear. He worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He was the only orthopedic surgeon in that area. The evidence was very clear. He spent all of his time doing that, was constantly doing charitable things for people. He was incredibly busy. His brother handled all those documents, handled all those letters, handled all of the business side. So when they put in those letters, that doesn't really show that. He also had at least two accountants, lawyers, telling him this is all legal. His intent and Mark's intent was the key issue in this case, and the defense was not allowed to present its best evidence of that in this case, and the conviction should be reversed.
Thank you. Very well. The case is submitted, and we will take it under consideration.